I always appreciate when speakers tell me from where they sit on the subject they're discussing, and I used to try to do that. The basis for my presentation today is in part on experience and in part on trying to keep up with some of the literature. In following John the Baptist's example, he started out selling what he was not. That's a pretty good example. I am not a physician for human beings. For animals, yes. Although it's at some risk you'd bring me your animals. I've spent a good deal of my scientific career in looking at the cancer from the standpoint of radiation-induced cancer and then the bioenvironmental impact of energy effluence on cancer causation. And a significant part of my time also at the University of California, which is 8 years, not only looking at radiation and radio elements on effects on animals, including radiation, but also includes viral carcinogenesis, that is the cause to what is the impact of viruses as far as cancer causation goes. The laboratory in which I directed there, which was called the Comparative Oncology Laboratory, my associates discovered, they were among the first in this country to find a leukemia virus in cats and then repeat it. They were the first to show feline sarcoma virus, the first with the woolly monkey fibrosarcoma virus, and most recently the gibbon virus, which is very exciting because recently there has been a report of a isolation of a virus in human leukemia or lymphosarcoma that is almost indistinguishable from the woolly monkey fibrosarcoma virus. And the disease in gibbons, gibbon ape, the hyalobatous layer, the white-handed gibbon that we discovered, the disease is very much like that in people. Much of my life has been spent on what we call animal models for human disease. In other words, within the animal kingdom and within people, if you look hard enough, you can probably find the model of the disease, if you look hard enough. If you have any biological problem, there is a sort of homogeny. In other words, you can probably find the disease. There are a number of diseases. We're still looking for models in animals. Right now, the gibbon ape virus is an interesting model. And we have, among other things, just tell you in my present situation, we have one of the models, Lafora's disease, an epilepsy in a dog, and muscular dystrophy, Chidiac Higashi, which is a chronic degenerative disease, some demyelinating diseases, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, the immunodeficiency in foals, in Arab foals, is very much like that in people, in children. In fact, I got a call one day from one of the outstanding scientists in Europe. He directs one of the outstanding laboratories in Holland. Von Beckham is his name. He's an outstanding immunologist and interested in cancer. And he was a Fogarty scholar this year. Fogarty is a scholarship by the National Cancer Institute. One day here within the last year, I got a call. And he says, "This is Dick Beckham. I'm down here at Richland. I want to come up and see you." I said, "For Pete's sake, what are you doing out here?" He goes, "I'm in Pullman, Washington now. And Pullman, Washington isn't the end of the world, but you can see it from there." you got to really want to come to Pullman. You know, you got to have a real good reason to want to come there. That's why I'm able to attract some very good faculty there. A lot of people are looking for those kind of places these days. But I says, "Why are you coming?" And he said, "Well, You have an outstanding model there for, because he's a physician too. You have a model for immunodeficiency, and I want to talk to your people. So that's the kind of game I'm in. Now the whole subject of cancer is a big one. It's a very challenging one. It's a very complex one, and you can't think of it as sort of one disease. Maybe it's 100, you know, because they manifest different. They probably have different causations, although there are some basic principles that obtain probably, many of which we do not fully understand. If we really understood them, we could do something about them. I'm not going to emphasize our own research in this today, but to try to make it, I might finish off with some of it or mention some of the research that's underway. But rather today I'm going to direct at some agents that we might be exposed to and some problems that have arisen as a result of them, and then look at the prevention, how we might prevent it. Maybe we'll discuss, as I mentioned, some of the causes and maybe some of the more recent therapy that has been utilized and some of the promising results that have been obtained. And that's a big order. The reason I stalled on my cancer presentation here, and I should have really stalled it off probably tomorrow, because I had a call one night, and I get these periodically, from the Gillings, who are great friends of the village, really great friends. And they have a daughter named Sandra, and she was going to do a paper on cancer. So they called me up, you know, what references you have. So I sent her a whole batch of references. And she put together a paper, and she decided, I think very wisely, she said, cancer, will people take the necessary steps toward prevention? The evaluation of the paper was attached. And the fellow said, a superior paper, great amount of information, interestingly related in precise and accurate language. It is an outstanding paper by a high school student. It really is. And I'm going to be referring to some of this as we go through here to pay a tribute to her for good work. But what I'd hoped is that she would have been here and she could have participated, because I like to bring people into the discussion. And you can, in this regard, the kind of presentations I usually give are improved if people interrupt. It can only improve them. So don't hesitate to interrupt at any time or challenge anything I any statement I may make. Now, what is the dimension of the problem? Well, it's substantial. From zero to age about 30, it's the second biggest killer, next to accidents, really. And after that, it's still the second biggest killer, then to heart disease. So it's a disturbing thing. I guess I wouldn't have had such great interest in it had it only been a disease of people my age and older. But the impact of it on the young is drives many of my associates to a pretty avid endeavor. Many of my associates, to an extent, it was pretty much night and day operation. Not only because the competition keen in the business, to get the grants, you got to show progress, you know. But there is this added driving force. If you ever seen a child, normal child, bubbly little thing at 10, and shows up with leukemia and it's gone in a year? If anybody needs prayers, it's those families of those people, and then the physicians that take care of them. If you go to the orthopedic in Seattle, and those physicians that face this every day, you can stand to look at death in the sun just so long. So it's that's an impressive disease. Before the end of this day, as every day, 1,000 people in this United States will die from some form of cancer. But we made remarkable strides in many areas, which I will mention before the end of the hour. What are some of the causes? Chances are the greatest percentage of the causes are environmental. Viral causation may be involved, but it may be incidental to some other promoting aspects. And let's just go over some of these that might be involved. And I guess we can start almost anywhere here. One of the interesting ones is skin cancer, but that's a pretty small percentage, 1% or so, I suppose. And this is in great part related to the color of the skin and how much sun you're exposed to. A lot of people speak of a healthy tan. You never hear that from me. I speak of unhealthy tans. I know, as I mentioned, some of you, well, back when I was in California, I'm sure when my children were younger, they were kind of embarrassed when I'd come to the pool, or they'd invite people over for the swim party, and I'd come out, you know, and they were embarrassed not only because of my knobby knees, but because I was very white. I don't go out for suntans. I didn't start it soon enough, but sun has a very great aging effect on skin, especially blondes. And it's also the more sunlight, the more chances of having tumors, including squamous cell carcinoma and also melanomas. Now, squamous cell carcinoma, if you have a cancer of the skin, if you're going to choose a cancer, that's probably one of the better ones, or at least worst ones. You can lick a lot of skin cancer, but I don't recommend melanoma. That's bad news, very bad news. Although there are some treatment methods now that show some promise.
Can you define what that is?
What, melanoma?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, you see some that's a precancerous lesion are blue molds. Blue mold. And that's of the melanin, the pigment in the body. We also have it in animals. In fact, the pig model, there was a grant recently funded at the University of Missouri. A fellow, in fact, who used to study with me, went there and made the observation of a high incidence of melanoma in miniature swine, and they're now following up on this. In horses, I think about 80% of all white or gray horses over the age of 16 show up with melanomas. Some of them are benign, but in people, once they start out, it's bad news. And you don't want a monkey with blue molds. And the physicians always look at mine here, see, you know.
Skin cancer removed this year. A tumor did turn out to be a cancer, so I'm not fair skin. So.
Yeah, and you live in Southern California, see? So you're very... Yeah. It's a very high incident in animals and people. Yeah. And some of them can get kind of mean. But for some of the superficial cancers today on treatment, a fellow I know named Edmund Klein, Roswell Park. He has quite a wide clientele because he treats cancer. And in fact, he has some very famous people who have been his clients, which I can't reveal. But I remember one time he showed us a series of slides, and this one lady was... in fact, what they were doing is considering quartering her. In other words, they were going to take off her arm and onto her shoulder here and then take off a right breast to get enough skin to cover up what they took off. I mean, it was bad news, and it was an infection as well as cancer. And but he tried a method that has been developed in recent times that shows some promise, and not only some chemical treatment, but BCG, the bacillus of Calmette and Gironde, which in Europe they use, was developed there, in fact, by a veterinarian and a physician. It's a vaccine, or it's a Bactrin, really. We call it a vaccine for your purposes, for tuberculosis. And what it does, it makes you hypersensitive. You know, the basis for the tubercular test is that you're hypersensitive to the tuberculin bacilli, right? And you put a little bit of that in, and boy, it blows up if you've been hypersensitized. Well, it mobilizes some cells in the body that fight cancer, is what's happening, you see. So what he did to this woman, he just, you know, scarified a great part of her back and put a lot of BCG in there. And the last pictures I saw of her, I mean, she still had her arm. I mean, they didn't go through surgery, and she was essentially cured. It's, you know, like a miracle, see. They've used it in some other situations, and it, in some areas it does show some promise, especially for superficial tumors. That takes care of skin. Perhaps we should dwell, with the limited time we have, on those cancers that are most prevalent. We start with lung, I guess. And I guess if we were really looking at it as a disease, like an infectious disease, cancer lung is really in epidemic proportions. I suppose 33% of the cancers in males, something like that. I better check Sandy's statistics, or she got them in here. But it's bad news as far as lung cancer goes, and among women it's increasing, and you're going to see quite an increase in this because among the people starting to smoke. Young girls are showing the highest increase, and I think that's insanity. Anybody that starts smoking today has to be insane or have a great deficiency. I mean, it's a terrible thing. It's absolutely a terrible thing. If we didn't have any smoking today, do you realize how many people would be saved? Would you believe 70,000 a year in the United States? For everybody who thinks about starting to smoke, I'd like to take them and watch a terminal lung cancer patient and have them spend a week with them, and then be there for the autopsy. That's why of the group that's more physicians than any other group have quit smoking. Not enough of them, but it's the worst addiction we have today. Bar none, for cost. And cancer isn't the only thing. I mean, one out of seven or eight will get cancer for sure, probably. We are beating the weed pretty hard. But there's also a high increase in other cancers. I mean, in other conditions, emphysema. You're almost sure you're going to get emphysema if you keep it up, or even if you quit after 50, 55, like the chief's father did. He should have, by genetically, he should have lived to be probably 85 or 90 in pretty good health, because he come from a long life family, and he was really looking forward to retirement because our children were his only grandchildren. They loved him and he loved them. He quit at 55, but by the time he retired, he couldn't walk a block without panting like an Airedale. Beat the weed, huh? And heart disease, increased cancer of stomach, increased oral cancer. And it seems to have a synergistic effect, incidentally, with liquor. There seems to be a co-carcinogenic effect with liquor. So that's the bad news there. What are some of the other hazards on the lung? Well, there's a lot of things that cause it. Fumes from many industries. I suppose benzene from smelting operations. Asbestos, terrible. Probably if you're an asbestos worker, you got about 100 times chance, 90 to 100 times chance of getting cancer of lung. And especially if you smoke. If you don't smoke, then you probably have it in the colon or something. But asbestos is bad news, like brake linings or asbestos. And one of the great contaminants, of course, as far as a load on the environment, are from brake linings and particulates from automobiles. But there's a lot of stuff, and rubber and brake linings are a great contributor to the load and the particulate material in the atmosphere. Nickel has some problems, and hydrocarbon fuels contribute significantly, although that isn't fully defined. In fact, the first time that a particle from a stack, from burning coal, for example, the first time that has been really observed on a in a scanning electron microscope, and just what it looks like, the first time this has ever been shown was on the cover of Science magazine within the last 2 months. By a former graduate student of mine and a present member of my former staff at the University of California. And the material that's in there is a really a whole array of stuff that's yet is not fully defined. But we know several of the agents are probably, could well be carcinogens. Yes?
How does smoking marijuana relate to lung cancer?
Yeah, I don't think we got enough experience. Because I don't know how many hydrocarbons or carcinogens are in there in marijuana as contrasted with cigarettes. There's also arsenic in cigarettes. But there's quite an array on cigarette smoke. But I don't know of any analysis. There probably has been some. But we don't have enough data. The experiment hasn't been run on sufficient people smoking marijuana with a control population, and the quantity. With cigarettes, we've had a lot of experience, whether they're one pack a day, two pack a day. And we should say also on the smoking, but there I imagine it's contributory, maybe, depending on, I imagine smoking anything, but you take uranium miners or other miners. But I know in the case of uranium miners, in one study, there were 55 in this study, 55 miners manifested cancer of the lung after considerable time. They were hard miners in uranium. 54 out of 55 had been were smokers, and the 55th one had smoked earlier. This is true with several industries, true in asbestos and other.
Does the smoking merely make the person more susceptible to the damage done by the additional chemicals?
Yeah, I'm sure that's one thing, but it itself is a carcinogen. And what you're having, you see, I think this is part of it. And you really won't have a cancer cannot be manifested in the absence of cell turnover. You've got to have multiplication of cells. Well, in the case of a smoker, you have a greater cell turnover for, say, in the lung. And so you have that, and other agents can impact on this. In the case of radiation, for example, radiation-induced cancer, say, leukemia, radiation reduces the amount of cells, it kills off a lot of cells, damages some, but whenever you have a reduction of cells, there's a stimulus. The body says we're counting too many cells, so you stimulate the body to produce cells, so you have increased cell turnover, and the more cell turnover you have a better chance of having cancer, especially in the presence of agents that cause it. But there are also inborn accidents. Maybe that's enough for lung cancer. And the trouble with lung cancer is It's pretty hard to treat once it, you know, it isn't something you want to bet too much money on. If it's pretty far along, although there's some people, Godfrey is still going, he had cancer along. So it's not impossible, but the odds are sort of against you. Unless you can get it quite a bit earlier. Now, there are some means for diagnosis. Earlier, we're going more into it, what we call exfoliate cytology. You try to get samples, you know, in the sputum and other things to check for oral cancer, and you look for abnormal cells. And cancer cells have, or precancer cells have a certain characteristic. So you look for those. That's the basis, for example, of your pap smear. That's exfoliate cytology. And they're working on that. And the National Cancer Institute, in cooperation with the American Cancer Society, set up a lot of screening programs, which are very helpful. I might think of some other things in lung cancer. I've hit quite a few of them. Our own concern here in the Science Advisory Committee, that's been meeting here off and on all week, one of our concerns here, and we're recommending a safety educational committee, but one of our concerns here, for example, and it's been a great concern to me, is the particulate material blowing off the mine tailings, is that carcinogenic? It probably isn't doing anybody any good. Well, one of the members of our science committee is one of the authorities of the world, Roger McClellan, on the hazards of inhaled particulates. Well, we're going to give him the constituents of it. I don't know if he can do any particle size determinations for us, but maybe we can get that done. On anything that impinges on the lung, the particle size determination, nature of the particle, is very important. And if you're a nose breather, there is little impaction of anything bigger than say 5 microns, which is very small. A micron is a 1/25, 5/1000th of an inch. So that would be 5/1000th of an inch. It's kind of small. You can't see it. But so that's an important aspect of it. The other area that I'm concerned about here. Are those people, and any of you here, I bring to your attention, is welding, and especially those people that are doing a lot of art welding here, cutting into anything they find in the mine, which may have nickel in it, arsenics, I don't know, a whole array of things that are carcinogenic, and if you're not using respiratory protection. And there have been some people who became ill here. I know one art instructor was doing a lot of it and felt pretty bad. Well, you know, that's bad news. If it isn't carcinogenic, it's also damaging. Some of that stuff's corrosive, you see. So that's one of the concerns we have in that regard. Just bring it to locally here. All right, another one that's a bad actor is mammary carcinoma in the female, and it's that's bad news. Until recently, we really hadn't done much for that. We hadn't made any progress much on it. There has been some progress in recent times. There's and here we, you know, we don't know some of the causes for it. There's some suggestion that certain of the estrogens that are in our diet or in our medicines, or maybe in high amounts in meat or liver, may contribute. The pill taken before one has child has been suggested as increasing the incidence. This is debated, however.
How about after one has a child?
Yeah, well, the data doesn't we don't have the data on it. I mean, it's conflicting. There's some studies that said it isn't related, and others say it is. But the data that I have seen only has a fair case for the one before. There are some improved techniques for diagnosis. What you must realize is that radiography, you know, X-ray, when you go in to have an X-ray, even if the equipment is very good, there has to be a 35 to 40% change to be visible on an X-ray. I'm sorry to bring that to your attention, but that's true. In other words, you can miss a lot with an X-ray, although they're improving their techniques. There are, however, some other things that have been developed that are absolutely fantastic. And using short-lived isotopes in what we call a Anger camera. In fact, we are the first ones to use this in animals before they tried some of the techniques in people. The University of California in cooperation with Berkeley. We could take an X-ray. We knew this dog had one cancer of the bone, which we saw an X-ray. And we went down there and we gave it first a fluorine 18, which has only a 110-minute half-life. And then we give it iron 52, and they're both positron emitters. That is, they emit particles simultaneously that go out 180 degrees, you see. Well, a guy named Anger, didn't have a PhD, incidentally. Anger got to thinking about this, and he said, if I build a detector, a whole bunch of detectors looking down on the table, and if I build them the same number underneath the table looking up, and if I fix the instrumentation so that if you have a positron emitter here, and it's emitting one particle off this way, and this particular detector sees it, the instrumentation will reject it if the one at 180 degrees down here doesn't also see it simultaneously. What this does for you, of course, makes for fine localization, doesn't it? You'll know just where that particle came from. Well, when we took this dog and put it on the Anger camera, boy, just a big white area showed up in one of the legs that you didn't even see with X-ray. And then we, after that decayed out, the animal's still asleep, give it iron 52. Well, I should tell you that fluorine 18 is a measure of bone blood flow. In other words, there was a large area in which there was increased bone blood flow in this one particular spot. And then if you take iron 52, which concentrates in bone marrow, among other places, so then you do the scan for iron 52, you look at that, which you would have never known by X-ray. Now there's an instrument built, in fact, for any of you in Yakima, even, they're buying one. It costs in excess of $500,000. And using isotope, you can essentially take me or you, and you can look through the person, sort of in centimeter strips, all down through the body to see what's happening. There's some really powerful tools being developed. And mammography and xerography, using, say, infrared or something, to see if there's areas in the breast that have a higher blood flow will be also warmer, and you have instruments that can read that. So there are some good techniques. There's a big argument going now, as you are well aware, whether the best treatment for mammary carcinoma is radical breast surgery, see? Because that is a radical operation. And if you do it young, well, if you do it any time, you know, if you take out lymph nodes, it isn't a pleasant thing, because you have something swelling of the limbs and stuff, and even the experts don't fully agree on this, because some of them are tied to mammary radical breast, others say radiation and less radical surgery, they can show just as good an effect. Certainly there's been some recent advances in chemotherapy. Pat, I'll just call her Pat, she worked in our cancer lab. She developed mammary carcinoma, and she went through radical, and then she left the laboratory, I guess after I did, and at that time she went to a physician, and it looked like it was in bone. And boy, one of the saddest letters I've gotten was from Pat. Brilliant, he's a brilliant scientist. She's a PhD from Oregon State. She had done a lot of very good work. She was younger than I am, I'm sure. And there she was kind of alone in Oregon and didn't know which way to turn. She didn't know, you know, these physicians, if they got the latest information. And you'd say, you know, as I read it, I said, boy, Pat isn't long for this world, you know. She'd sort of figure that out too, I guess. Certainly afraid of it. And so I said, well, I got on the phone and called a friend of mine named Parker at University of Washington. And then got a hold of her right away, and because I wanted her to go and see him. And now that's been about a year and a half ago. And she went up there, and I got a long letter from her. I mean, she really felt good about it. She said they treated her like it was their mother. And that's always happy to hear. And he gave me a full report on it. But then I recommended her. She was trying to teach at Linfield. She got a job at Linfield. She taught this last year. And I just got a letter from the physician this last week and said that she's still clear. You know? Well, the point of that story is to tell you there's been some remarkable progress in chemotherapy. The Italians, there's something called L-PAN, which has been proven really quite effective. Radiation, of course, can cause cancer, but it's also one of our best controls. Now, this one of my associates, frankly, a classmate of mine. Now, he must be 55, and I suppose that it's been 20 years. He's still clean. And there's quite a few people like this. So, is that a cure? Well,
I was treated for it last year, and my grandfather's down here. When he first said it, said it's a 90 to 95% quote cure, and yet when you finish treatments, they won't give you those words. And so when I finished last summer, I was at Mayo for treatments, and I said, well, what do I say? Do I have it? I had it, or what? And he says, you were treated for it at such and such a time.
Yeah.
So it's a factor there, and yet my last checkups have all been holding there.
So, you know, we often think, in the cancer world, you speak of 5 year. Five-year survivals. Now, that brings up a point. I'll divert here a bit on childhood leukemia, which is a special interest, although it's a small percentage of people. But it has caught our attention because of the tragedy associated with it. Now, I would say in 10 years ago, the five-year survival on acute childhood leukemia was probably 5%. And that isn't, that's the kind of odds I don't like. Well, there's been some developments. I wish they were better methods, but Don Pinkel, people at St. Jude's in Memphis, developed technique where, see, it's subject to using chemotherapy agents, and you can really cause them to go into remission, but then it comes back. Well, they reasoned that if you radiate in the subarachnoid space, they thought might be a source of it, you know, the covering around your brain and upper spinal cord. They thought, well, maybe that's where those cells are hiding out, and maybe the chemotherapy doesn't get to them, and that's the cause of the disease manifesting itself again. So what they do is to radiate with about 2,500 R, which if you took that whole body, it would kill you. Know? But they don't give it all at once; they give it over a couple-week period. And the last I heard on their results, they'll have probably in excess of 50 to 60 to 70% 5-year survival. I don't know what the long-term effects fully of 2,500 to the head is. Maybe effectively, but if you have a child, it's, you know, doing well. I'll give you another example. When I reviewed the cancer program on a review team for University of Washington, there are many. There are about 17, 19 cancer centers now throughout the country. One of them is the Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle. Or if you live in a major city down in Southern California, USC has one, and the University of Illinois, Sydney Farber and Moss, Boston. Some of them are cooperative. We might have one in Wisconsin. But anyway, there's a lot of them. But the cancer group that eventually became Cancer Center at Seattle, a fellow named Donnell Thomas, was in charge of this, and he developed a program. He started off on dogs first. I should go back a step. In the early days in the radiation business, we felt very good that, by golly, maybe we're going to lick leukemia, because it's cancer of the white cells. See? And there's various kinds of white cells. Some of them are radiation sensitive than others, but most of them are quite radio sensitive. In other words, they're killed by a small dose of radiation. And they come from the bone marrow. Well, we also developed a technique for bone marrow transplantation. You take my bone marrow and put it in somebody like my bone marrow, except there's problems there. But anyway, early on, they thought, boy, this is a really good deal, because you'd irradiate the whole body of a person with doses that would kill all their white cells, and you'd go in there with some good white cells and get them going again. See? And then you'd have wiped out the cancer. Well, like a lot of theory, it's ruined by ugly facts. And it certainly proved out in mice, but you had to be very careful about bone marrow, because you might get the bone marrow established from the donor, but then it reacts unfavorably immune-wise to the host. They did a lot of studies on this, and there's been a lot of studies immunologically to look at compatibility. And what Donnell Thomas did was to look at not parents, because you're sure you're only halfway there with a parent. You see, you look at siblings, and then you give them supportive therapy, and you give them bone marrow from the other child. The child I saw was a boy, 12 years old, who had leukemia, and he irradiated with 1,000 R, and he then gave him the bone marrow from his sister. And you can tell by looking at the white cells, one kind of white cells, whether it's from a boy or a girl. And the cells that the boy has, even today, are his sister's cells. They're growing. And they were not rejected, because there was enough similarity in this particular case, so they accepted him. Now, when I saw him, he was 3 years out. Now, there's no way that he would have survived, because he was at those times only taking those that were, it was a last resort. And the boy, he was smaller than his sister. He was only 8 or 9. So, you know, it might well stunt him, but he was a happy lad going to school. So that's another method, just to bring up the leukemia thing. It's well that we address the genetic aspects of it. I mentioned the effect of genetics on longevity. I mentioned our father-in-law, who should have lived longer. I remember what Sir John Hammond told me when we were discussing age, and Sir John Hammond was one of the outstanding animal scientists of the world. And he visited our laboratory one day, and he was then toothless and a very old man. But we got off into aging and how one ensures a long life. And he says, well, I recall what old man Pearl told me in 1908. He says, the way to ensure a long life is to pick a mother with a long life. Well, that's kind of hard to do, but it shows the truth of that the genetics do enter into this. And there are, as we, for example, in mice, which is a very good example, if you want a mouse that has a 50% incidence of a certain type of lung tumor at 18 months of age, you can probably get it. If you want one with a 80% incidence of mammary carcinoma at the age of 12 months, you can probably get it. I mean, in other words, we bred mice, inbred mice, so you can essentially almost get what you want. If you want to, my mouse work was in one experiment, my lifespan was based on a mouse that had a very low incidence of tumor. Another experiment, I picked three kinds of mice that had a low incidence of radiation and two things. Tumor, and one with a high incidence of radiation induced tumor, and then one with a special kind of tumor. So you can kind of get an item, but that serves to introduce to you the fact that there's a suggestion of high incidence families and low incidence families of certain kinds of tumors. While we're talking about women, a recent scare. It might have been over. There was overreaction because it was a very dramatic thing. In the last war, in the big war, certain women took a something called DES, diethylstilbestrol, a hormone preparation, synthetic, to prevent miscarriage. And many, many years later, their offspring manifested an unusual vaginal tumor that was very rare. It appears to be a cause and effect relationship here. And this is part of the concern expressed by many people and our own Food and Drug Administration relative to the utilization of DES in as food additives. Today we use a lot of stimulants for increasing the feed utilization in animals. DES probably lowers the cost of your beef by maybe 10%. I mean, it would take 10% more feed to raise to a certain level of a market weight of a steer. 10% more feed in the absence of diethylstilbestrol. Now, the thing there was that they allowed it to be used, and I think rationally, that if you wait a little while, if you take them off diethylstilbestrol and let it biotransportation and elimination, normal elimination in a period of a short time, it's essentially all gone. People got really uptight about this, and a few people got the word to look at the price of the beef and say, boy, let's run them to market today, you know. We'll shorten the time that they're off diethylstilbestrol maybe to 24 hours. I imagine there was some of this, although the amounts pound weren't that significant. But that was the big scare, or one of the big scares. And we're still knocking it around. What else? Uterine cancer increased by estrogens in menopausal women. That's debated today. And I don't know. That isn't my business, so I'm not going to make a judgment there. All I know is what I read in literature. The other thing is bowel cancer, which is one of the highest. I mentioned lung cancer and mammary, uterine is very high. But cancer of the bowel is really very high in the United States. In certain other populations, very low, very low. Us and the Japanese, much lower in Japanese. In certain African tribes, as Dr. Burkitt noted, is essentially almost, you hardly ever see it. Of course, Or that may be related to their length of life. I don't know. I haven't talked to Bricker about it. Bricker is a very interesting fellow. He's a Bible thumping and sort of missionary type guy. He belongs to the same group as Paul Tournier, Christian physician group, international group. And he's a fellow that discovered Burkitt's lymphoma in Africa, which is, you've seen these little black children with their eyes out here, and you know, they're really terrible looking. It's the kind of leukemia. And the virus that was found associated with this is called EB virus, Epstein-Barr. Epstein-Barr are English research workers. I don't know Barr, I know Epstein. And it's the same virus that's been associated with infectious mononucleosis in this country. Same virus. And they think it's caused it, but there's been a big push by some people, Epstein is one of them, who'd like to vaccinate for this, to develop a vaccine. Now, the only vaccine that's been used with a DNA virus to date that I know of, and effectively, is in poultry. It was developed by some veterinarians for Merrick's disease, which is it's bad news for the poultry industry until they develop this vaccine. And partially on the basis of that success, they like tried, but it does lend itself to therapy there, and so there's some big arguments in high places. You've heard of soft. But there's a possibility of some vaccines. We were working on one for cat, feline sarcoma, and when I visited Glasgow last year, the fellows who discovered feline leukemia first time were felt very confident they were going to come up with a vaccine. But it'll be a while before they try it on EB. But that's to sort of introduce Burkitt, because what Burkitt was interested in is, and he spent a lot of time in Africa, I suppose medical missionary work and stuff, is to look at doing epidemiological studies. In other words, he looks at incidence of certain diseases, chiefly here cancer, and then he tries to relate it to maybe how they live, what they eat, and all of that. And he's a great authority now on bowel movements. You can hear his presentation on bowel movements. I mean, what is a good bowel movement and what isn't, you know? And he says, Europeans, Americans have lousy bowel movements. But the most recent discovery in the field of nutrition is the importance of fiber. And some of this is based on Burkitt, at least among some of the nutritionists. High sugar diets with low bulk is probably, to an extent, our undoing. And for many years, you know, we go on a soft diet. Now in diverticulosis, and I speak firsthand in experience, since I'm one of a large percentage of people over the age of 50 who have diverticulosis. And so you, in the old days, you know, you go on a soft diet. Now you try to go on a bulk diet, Metamucil. I'll be on Metamucil till they discover something else. And so I guess the take-home story there is, there is probably something to it, that if you have a lot of bulk, you may reduce the incidence of some diseases. Burkitt says, well, he lists a whole bunch of them, heart disease, gallbladder, you know, he goes down the list, cancer of the bladder, because my African friends who have a lot of bulk don't have it, you know. Well, I don't know. But certainly cancers and other problems, there's a great association between what we eat, how we live, and the agents we're exposed to. I don't think there's any question about that.
Heard anything new about the spices of South American Mexicans? The high incidence of bowel cancer too.
Yeah. I used to drink a lot of Russian tea. I took out all the ingredients but the lemonade and tang. I quit eating pepper, so all of those I've knocked out. And
you know, there's a recent newspaper article about cancer being caused by the wood products in this region.
Some of the resins, or, you know.
Are you familiar with that?
Oh, it doesn't surprise me that some of the material in it, practically anything will cause cancer if you take enough of it. And that brings, I'm glad you asked that, because we have a disparity here. Because you do a lot of these studies, a lot of the agents that you take have been tested, you know, there's a requirement for testing by a small rodent, usually a mouse, and then maybe a shorter period of time, and I won't go into the regulations on this, a larger animal, and you take them through reproduction and a bunch of stuff. Well, a while back, they took away cyclamate. I bought up a lot of it because I didn't believe the data, and I'm still using it. I think that you people here would have a chance of having a slight increase in bladder carcinoma if you from cyclamate, if you drank, say, 600 or 700 bottles of Unicola every day. But before that, I think you'd have other problems. That's about how I look at that. Public pressure. Say it's a carcinogen. How they test it is that they put these little pills, they make up the material with maybe beeswax or something and put it in the bladder of rats. Well, this isn't exactly how you're exposed to it, you know. So you question the testing method, but this is sort of a standard test. Yeah, this sometimes happens.
And at the American public doesn't realize it.
Yeah. You see, I wish I had a blackboard here, but here it is.
I wonder if this is safe to remove.
Yeah.
All right. Here is we run into this in radiation too. I'll move it over there. It's on the test method. And
can we help you with that, Leo?
As long as I keep it close into me, I won't slip a disc again. And here's how we test, you see. This is the XY axis, and you always say, here is dose of a given material, and here is the effect, the biological effect, which in this case may be cancer, with a given dose, with the dose increasing. And like in radiation, which I spend most of the time, you say, well, out here, you get this kind of an effect, this many cancers with that dose here, and then maybe you get about this much here, and maybe this much, and then they draw the line through to here, and say with a dose that's infinitesimal, you still get just a little bit, you get quite a bit, you see. Well, in most everything that we have tested, there might be a few exceptions to this, is that the shape of this curve, and this is hard to determine down here, but the chances are maybe linear here, but it isn't a linear effect. It's what we call a sigmoid effect, and that you can, it takes a little bit, quite a bit to cause an effect, but then the effect is increased. It's sort of a, what we call a practical threshold. And, you know, the, what is that bill? It says that if it shows cancer, if it's ever been described as causing cancer, you can't use it in anything. If it's shown to cause cancer in a rat, well, you know, I can put cellophane in the belly of a rat and cause cancer. There aren't very many agents that you don't use in high enough amounts. There's some, but not very many. And so that's a matter of interpretation. I'll give you an example of this. Selenium.
by one experiment, I don't know how good it was, showed it caused cancer. Yet selenium happens to be a requirement I know it's required in animals, and I suppose in people. The toxicity level is fairly low, but it's required. Certain enzyme systems in the pancreas, for example.
So Pardon?
Yeah, this is another one that's been recently assaulted. That we just have to get you. But I served on the Food Protection Committee of the National Academy for quite a while, and most of the food additives I know are, you know, they're pretty well tested out.
You know, I was recently heard a couple of TV programs in which nutritionists were talking about foods that were particularly bad, and always mentioned were instant potatoes, as if that was something, there was something more deadly about instant potatoes.
Is that right?
Or potato flakes than other things. I don't know what kind of credentials she had, but I thought it was interesting that particular product was more mentioned than other things.
I haven't heard that. There's a lot of things I haven't heard of, but it was never came up in Food Protection Committee, because I've been off it for a year and a half or so. What else? Therapy. There's been some interesting results recently on some treatment of bone cancer. One of the later reports out of NCI. I guess Kennedy's boy is still holding. We were working some on animals on this. That was a bad one. It's still a bad one. Pancreas is bad news. You want to say something as a physician?
About stress related to cancer.
Yeah, I have my own views on that. Oh, hi, Ken. And I don't know how good the data is, but there are probably quite a few instances where the wife dies in very old age with cancer, and not too long after the husband also dies with. I think stress is very important in this, because I think a stressful situation can cause an effect on the body that is hormonal related and immune related. And I'll give you an example of this. There are indications that the people who have had kidney transplants show a great increase in cancer, incidence of cancer. Now, in kidney transplant, many of them, you have to compromise the immune system to prevent them from rejecting the transplant. And I think in a lot of children, it used to die from respiratory disease and a lot of other things that we now control. I'm not so sure that their immune system was that good. And there are probably some of those that have this is a gut reaction now, have a higher incidence of tumors. But I think stress definitely has an effect on a number of diseases, and I do not exclude cancer. Yes?
I heard a little bit about an immune response, having a bone production interferon inhibits cell virus replication. Are there any studies being done?
Yes.
The possibility. We talk about prevention, but just really.
Yes, to stimulate the body, And this is, there's a good deal of effort on trying to stimulate the body in the production, say, of T cells to respond to this, to try to mobilize the body defenses for a certain to reject this or to modify an antigen. It's also utilized in diagnosis. They find out that by immunoassay, you can detect some unusual antigens that help you in early diagnosis of certain diseases. Might be mammary, colonic. There's some recent evidence in one of the last reports I got from NCI. There were several agents identified. We have some very sophisticated techniques now in analyzing materials within the body, from the body, that really help in early diagnosis, and this is one of the real keys, you know. Well, if you got something wrong with you, you know, don't put it off till next year. Yes?
I was wondering if you had been studies on skin cancer, relationship to suntan lotions and things like that, if that does anything to prevent it at all? Or?
No, I don't know that.
The only thing I can add to that is sunscreens.
If it's sunscreens, yeah.
Yeah.
If you can reduce the ultraviolet that gets to the skin.
Sure, aminobenzoic acid, like cut out the short rays.
Yeah.
And the nice part about skin cancer, though, with the exception of melanoma, is that they're almost not 100% curable. Detected early, squamous and mucous.
Yeah. And cervical, if you get that early, it's certainly high, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
This is Dr. Gamrath, and he might wish to make some other comments about any of this.
Nothing more than you've added there, except that I think the strides are being made because there's more cooperation between groups now. Before there were isolated groups, California group versus this group. Now I think the consolidation due to government grants is
It's a forced job, because you see what's happening now, like Kennedy's committee recently had Frank Rauscher, who's head of the National Cancer Institute, before the committee. Like I have the proceedings of this one, and he wants to know, what are you doing about getting the results out to Dr. Gamrath and these other people, rather than just localizing in a few centers? What are you? How are these things being utilized? And boy, they laid on them heavy. You know, you got to get this stuff out. And they've been critical of saying, you said take some of the money from the research and do this. Well, my point is to, you got to do this, but you also have to do the research. And I'm going to make that point in just a minute. But they are under constraints to do this, and they're trying to localize cancer centers to help this in the educational process and also for referral. And right now, there are cancer centers scattered throughout the United States, so that over half the population in the United States today will within 120 miles can get to a cancer center. And that's the way it's set up. So that's I think you make the point well. It's a very important point that this that's one of the reasons that more of this is getting out to more people, and they're under the gun. They better do it. Now on the research, a lot of people, well, they've been critical. I know of the viral program that maybe it doesn't have that much to do, and you've probably recently read that Dr. Safiati quit and he blasted the Frank Rauscher and the gang in the National Cancer Institute, saying, you know, probably 80% of the cancer is caused by chemicals, and you only give us, I don't know, 40 million, and you're giving viral cancer 90 million. You see, well, there are these kind of decisions that are being made, and the priority is pretty hard to set. And Frank Rauscher himself, he's got a virus, a mouse virus named after him, the Rauscher sarcoma virus. So maybe you say, well, maybe he's more interested in that. Well, the other part is, how much can you do? And you learn a lot of the mechanism if you're into viral, although the direction we're going now in our present setup, the one I'm encouraging, is to look more at the environmental health, environmental agents. And that's partially based on what, also what resources you have. But I want to make a point on basic research and fundamental research. And there one of the best studies on this been done in recent times by a group of experts. I mean, they were very qualified to do this. It was led by Julius Comerow, who is an outstanding cardiovascular man at UC San Francisco. He's internationally recognized. And he assembled a bunch of scientists, and what they did was to look at the cardiovascular field and examine, say, the 10 findings, or the 10, maybe it wasn't 10, but something like that, applications that have really helped the patient with cardiovascular disease. What led up to this? Was it money for application? Was it a planned kind of a program directed towards correcting this particular condition, whether it was atherosclerosis or some aspect of that? And their conclusion was that I think it was 60-80% of all the research and all the experimentation that went on to make this applicable to you as the patient was a fundamental research. It was a fundamental experiment not designed to answer your problem. That three-fourths of them didn't have this in mind at all. You have to look at it this way. I'll never forget what C.G. King said, who was head of the Nutrition Foundation for many years and a PhD from Washington State University. I was in nutrition at the time, doing graduate work in nutrition right after the war. And he said something that really impressed me. He said, probably for every application, an applied experiment, there's probably 1,000 fundamental experiments that have to be done, fundamental piece of knowledge that you've got to have to do it. Well, that's a round figure, but there's just a lot of data. And we can go through a lot of experiments where they didn't have that in mind when they set out. Frankly, where we are in biomedical science and a great part of the advances in biomedical sciences have been made during Dr. Gamrat's life, in his life, what we know about it. Yet there's so much we don't know. I liken it, like I maybe said the other day, we're rubbing two sticks together, and now and then we see a spark. But we really haven't got a fire going. I can sit down and tell you even simple things that we don't know, because we're dealing with very complex systems. How does the membrane on a cell work? Wish I knew.
I was wondering, this is some time ago that I read in a university publication, somebody from the University of Minnesota was working with this bile clock. He felt the best time to treat cancer was at a certain time. Mm-hmm. You know anything about that?
Not that specifically, but I'll tell you about biological clocks. And it depends on, we're different at different times of the day. For example, a rat. I can give it a radiation dose at one time of the day where they all survive, another time of the day where maybe half of them are killed. It varies on their state. And maybe cell turnover, because there are certain systems that shut down at night versus the day. In the case of a rat, it's a nocturnal animal, so it's very active at night. And to an extent, we may be the same way. So there are certain things that are functioning, and it depends then on the cell system you're dealing with. And we are cyclic beasts. If you do any jet travel, like Karin Haleem is just here, you know, when I fly to Europe or back, it's terrible. I'm wide awake over there in the middle of the night and fall asleep during the day, meetings and days. But if you go north and south the same distance, you don't have this, to an extent. So there are physiological changes, many of them not fully understood. A friend of mine did studies on this where they flew people halfway around the world, east and west, and then also north and south. There's a big difference. Of course, the Japanese pilots told you that to begin with. They go to fly to Australia and back to Japan, no sweat. But they fly to San Francisco, and boy, they were almost a hazard to get right in and fly right back. And in your own, the activity within certain cell systems in the body. Well, like I said the other day, I'm a morning person. Something's functioning in me in the morning that ain't that red hot with the chief. And you know some people like this, I took my PhD at University of Washington. There was a guy there. I never saw him. Well, I'd sometimes see him in the morning because he'd be leaving to go home. When I come to work at 6 in the morning, he'd just be leaving. He was great at night, all bright and smiley, 10 o'clock at night, off to go. Yes?
What about the whole inland field thing? When you're thinking about Arnie Scott and the material
that
you're using, is that just because that sort of thing you could absorb?
Probably. Well, that he was, that he wouldn't vomit back up, maybe, I don't know.
Was there a lot of, I don't know, kind of things in the way?
Yeah. That's the problem with this. You're desperate and you try anything.
I found last year during treatment that I wasn't able to eat. I went for days, and one time I went 7 days straight, and I wasn't even able to keep a sip of water down. Yeah. But the weirdest things is what I could eat when I could try. Yeah. It was rhubarb season, so I went through rhubarb, I went through grapefruit, I went through cantaloupe. It was the tartest, acidiest stuff that there was, but that's what I could,
but you would, she was taking a lot of radiation in this area, right?
First year, then.
And down. Yes?
It seems that when you're putting a lot of stuff in the body, it seems to clear. I'm wondering about the practice of these athletes now, using these massive doses of steroids.
Having weighing 50 pounds or something
like that, is there any evidence that may have some sort of a...
go ahead.
Well, that's frowned on quite a bit now.
Well, it's against the rules.
Yeah. And there hasn't been enough work done on that to really substantiate what's going on. They find that muscle mass diminishes with the decreased dose. They lose muscle mass.
Does it do anything on the development of self?
They haven't done enough work with that, Jerry. They're doing a lot of work with that in sports medicine now. But see, since it was banned, they're getting the guys who used it, the wrestlers and the weightlifters, mostly. But they haven't done enough work on it yet.
Don't take anything you don't have
to. I'm not going to go
it's like Katharine Hepburn is one of my favorites. If it works, leave it alone, So. Anything else? I got another appointment, so I got to go. Yes.
How about people who take treatment for allergies who are allergic to us, and how do the expression of rate?
The incidence?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with any good studies. I've always been suspicious that they may well have a different incidence because the immune system is involved.
I've never heard of anything.
The immune system is jazzed up. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Thank you.